It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 322 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, I get to talk with a creator that I met out at Emerald City Comic Con very recently, Andrew Cafori. He's the driving force, or at least one of the driving forces, behind Nomad, a series of interesting books that's kind of a mixture of mythology, fantasy, and even a little sci-fi thrown in for good measure. His first trade is out, and it's called Nomad, The City of Empty Towers. And we talk about that in depth, and then we get to the second series that he's coming out with. And the first one is available, and I got that at ECCC, and it's called Nomad, The Cave of Broken Tombs. We get into that as well, including the future of Nomad and what kind of wonderful things we can expect from him and his terrific team of creators working with him that makes this book really shine for me. We talk about how he got into comics and his background and how that influences his writing and his creations. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Andrew Cafori, the creator, writer anyway, and I'm sure had a lot more to do behind the scenes of a really interesting franchise, I guess you could call it, called Nomad. How are you doing today, Drew?
I'm good, thanks.
It's good to talk with you. I got to meet you at Emerald City Comic Con very recently, which I was really glad to do. As I told you before we started to record, I go to conventions now looking for comics like yours so that I can find new creators that I can talk to about materials that I think people should know about. And I think Nomad is one of those kinds of things that I really enjoyed. I like something different. I like variety. And I thought that Nomad was just that kind of thing that I'm looking for. So I wanted to tell you that I really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for saying so. We tried to make it singular. We knew we weren't going to be the best because there's just too much good stuff out there. So we wanted to make something that no one had ever seen before.
Well, you should tell your story. That's the thing I always tell people. Don't try to do what other people are doing or try to measure yourself by what other people are doing. Tell your thing. And why don't you, in fact, why don't we just start off by having you describe what is Nomad about?
Wow. Nomad is... Nomad is kind of a world where spirituality and mythology and technology all collide in, sort of an epic battle for the, the souls of all the people involved and the fate of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about a hero who goes in quest of these intruders that threaten his world. And our hero is a chief of a tribal people on a planet that is similar to Earth but very different. And they've never seen technology before like this. And he's sent to smite these intruders, and his journey takes him across the storms at sea, where he has to come to a seemingly empty city and unravel the mystery of what's there. Mm-hmm. And what's there are, intruders from another planet who have come to enslave a ruling race and harvest their orbs of power to use as fuel for their ships. Mm-hmm. And our hero has to go through a series of challenges to combat these intruders, and he has to earn a divine amulet of a goddess in order to defy them. Mm-hmm. And the goddess is deeply rooted in his people's spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so he has to really learn about himself in order to become the person he needs to be to take what is wrong and set the world right.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to start off by talking about the fact that Nomad is not spelled the way that's like Captain America, for example. When he wasn't Captain America, he picked up the identity of Nomad. That's just N-O-M-A-D. But when you have it, it's N-O apostrophe M-A-D-D, which adds a little bit of a mythological feel to it. Was that the idea when you came up with the name that way, was to give it this, because you've talked about the combination of like mythology and all kinds of like sci-fi even and kind of fantasy stuff. Was that the thing you wanted to accomplish by having the name this way?
Yeah, I think it's capital N O apostrophe and then lowercase M-A-D-D. So it's Nomad. And the story is taken from his point of view, at least the first book is. And Nomad's people they're kind of gentle warriors. And so they have kind of a way of expressing or communicating that's sort of very soft, but at the same time powerful. And so I wanted the spelling of his name to be something that was distinct, heroic, and also and had that soft, powerful element to it. I don't know if I succeeded, but I was trying. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, you know, Nomad is the hero who, you know, is alone and doesn't quite fit into the world he's from or the world he goes into anymore. And so there was that aspect of it too. So it was taking that familiar story and putting a spin on it to make it unique for us.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did the concept come from? I mean, you know, you're working with other folks. Some names I'm probably going to butcher, but Todd Herman is providing the art, particularly on the first one, and then Lee Moyer, and I'm Tom Orzechowski, maybe.
Tom Orzechowski, yeah. He led the Uncanny X-Men and the New Mutants, and he does Spawn, and he's an industry legend. I say getting to work with Tom is like getting to jam with Metallica when you've got a little garage band. That's what it feels like. It's like we're rocking out in our garage and all of a sudden, you know, the bass player from Metallica shows up and is like, "Hey, you guys want me to add to your jams?" That's just what it feels like. He's, you know, I grew up reading all of the books he lettered. And by the way, the significance of good lettering cannot be understated. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that the letterers get enough credit in this industry for what they've done to make these stories readable.
Well, I have to say, because I help with a comic too, and one of the things, it's not a real comic until the lettering is done.
That's right.
You've got to be able to, it's got to look like a comic at some point. And when you start getting the lettering in there and it comes back like that, you just kind of look at it and then you start to read it like a comic. So yeah, I agree with you. I think the letterers, they don't get nearly the credit that should. But
we should all go to Comic Cons and be like, who lettered these comics? Where's the second for the letterers? Let's take the movie stars and like put them in a smaller area than we have the letterers and give the letterers like more. Now I understand that for the illusion of everything it won't work that way, but it should. Mm-hmm. It should, because that really is their significance to the medium.
It's just amazing to me because like in your book, for example, you have at the beginning of chapters, you have like a little, I don't know what you want to call it, like a poem almost.
Yeah. So I think you were actually, you asked me just to go back. You said like, so what was the inspiration for the mm-hmm. story? And so a little bit about me, I was a child actor as a kid and I worked in hundreds of plays for children's, literally hundreds of them, in Portland, Oregon. And then I had a handwriting disability where I'm very dyslexic and, you don't ever want to see my handwriting. So but I liked stories and I liked telling stories. And so what I did was, we had an old word processor machine and I taught myself how to speed type on that. So when I was about 12, I could type 90 words a minute.
Wow.
And, so I had a background in theater and I had, overcome, some difficulties by learning how to give myself the ability to write, at least, write. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to go into, being a playwright. And I got to New York City in 2004 and there were not a lot of opportunities at that time. And so my idea was that I was going to write stage plays that were, you know, science fiction, fantasy oriented or superhero oriented and things like that. And I wrote one about a character who was alone in the desert, and he had to survive the long hot days, the long cold nights, and there was lack of food and water, and there were creatures that were out to get him. And there was a hooded enemy that was veiled in secrecy who lurked in the nearby cliffs that was tormenting our hero. And I was submitting scripts around in about 2010, 2011. So I think that script was back in 2004. And so I around 2010, 2011, I was submitting stuff, and people said, well, of all the things you sent us, this was the one that stood out. So I wanted to get that illustrated. So I worked with an illustrator to try to illustrate that sequence. And from there, we started, you know, building a world around this character. And the world is rooted in my experiences, like living in New York City, and my experiences, in life. And there was just a ton of help that all the illustrators who worked on the project and anyone who's ever, you know, come in to be a part of the team has brought to it.
Well, I have to say, you've developed the world. You know, they always talk about world building and stuff like that. I like the fact that there are maps along the ways. And like I was talking about, go ahead.
Yeah, maps and poems, right.
Yeah. And the poems, talk a little bit about the poems, because you don't often read that. You know, most comics tend to be word balloons. You know, mm-hmm. with you, you're taking much more of a literary look at it, which I kind of enjoy.
Yeah, I wanted it to have that classical literary feel to it. And I think that for me, I was just thinking about, the classic hero's journey as an epic poem. And we needed to have information given to the reader in a timely manner. And there was a lot of backstory. And the best way to put that backstory in there to give that information to the reader was to do a little foreword before each chapter. And the foreword was the hero's thoughts. And that's where that came from.
I'm interested. But how did you make the jump from writing scripts for the visual medium to going into comics? I mean, were you a comics fan before?
Oh, wow. My gosh. Yes. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. I went home from school and watched cartoons. I watched cartoons on Saturday morning, and I went to the comic book store, and I got the X-Men and Batman and Ninja Turtles and all good things and Superman. And so, yeah, absolutely. I am a child of the 80s, literally born in 1980. So all of that marvelous stuff that was given to me, is there. So yes, absolutely.
Well, that's cool, because you get that sense that there's something deep going on. That there's this, it's more than just a superhero book, you know. And as much as I love the Long John's books, and I buy a lot of them, I like the sense that this is, you talked about mythological and all those kinds of things. I enjoyed that. And one of the things that brings that out to me is the artwork. Because mm-hmm. you're not doing the standard four-color artwork. You're doing a what they call a duotone, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's Lee Moyer. Yeah, Todd Herman did the pencils and the inks. And originally, when we'd published that book, it was just done in the Copic marker, and it came out all gray. And Lee Moyer came in and he painted it. He painted it all it's blue. Like the whole world is shadowy and blue. And I guess you'd have to see it to describe it. But just to understand that, I guess you just have to understand Lee Moyer. Lee's just brilliant. He was one of the first artists to ever draw Game of Thrones for George R. R. Martin in the 90s. I think he's, he's one of the first artists to ever draw the White Walkers, if not the first artist to ever draw the White Walkers. He's done book covers for Clive Barker. He's done work with Neil Gaiman. He's just unbelievable. And he's worked for my mother, who runs a children's theater company in Portland, Oregon. He's worked for her for 20 years. And so he agreed to come in and help us. And he became the seasoned veteran who literally made everything work. And he read the story. He understood the spirit of the story, and he made it a reality. Or as close to a reality as we could get.
Yeah, because the blues are different. You know, blue is my favorite color, I have to say. So right away I was like, ooh, blue, I like that. But then I also got into the various shades of the blue are used, you know, very well to indicate different things are going on, which I liked real well. And I also have to say, there are splash pages, especially as we get towards the end of the very first story, there are these wonderful splash pages, just blew me out of the water. I just had to sit there and, you know, from corner to corner, make sure I got to look at it all, because it was just fantastic.
Well, one of the things Lee Moyer does, and everyone I know who's worked with him will say this, is first thing he does is he sits you down and he tells you everything you did wrong. And then he tells you what he's going to do to make it right. And then he makes it right. And that's just, and a lot of people have that story. And one of the things he said to us was, he said, your goddess is the most important character in the story. And she is your bread and butter. And though she's not in, she's not seen a lot, her presence looms over everything, because Nomad's people have a sacred relationship with the divinity, you know, like with the moon in the sky. They see the moon in the sky as that which lights the world when the world is dark, and it's beautiful to them. And they believe that to earn the love of the divine is the greatest honor that is possible. But I should be clear, the love does not mean, intimate love. It's the love of the family. It's the love of your neighbor. It's the love of your children. And there is a little bit of that too. There's a little bit of the intimate love as well. It's such a combination of what it means to love. And Nomad is in quest of her love, like all people in his tribe are. And what he doesn't know, and as the story evolves, is he does have a relationship with the divine. And so Lee took that idea and he spun it to make her presence felt throughout the entire story. And he does that with the shades. So if the moon is in the sky, who is the moon shining light on, you know? Mm-hmm. That reveal about their knowledge of the adventure at hand and stuff like that.
There's a big reveal about something that's going on, and I would never spoil it. But it's just this wonderful thing. When I got to it, I went, oh my gosh, I said, that is what's going on here. I guess it explains so much, you know, because I was enjoying the story, but I love it when something comes along and it reveals to us kind of the undergirding of what's going on in the story. And that's what happens in this book. You've got a real big surprise, a big shock for us as you go along. I love to be surprised. I have to be honest with you.
About the third chapter?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I'm glad that surprised you. That's cool.
I have been reading comics for decades, and it takes something to surprise me these days. And so when I got to that, I went gasp, and I said, oh my gosh, that makes the book stop being a good book and turns it into a great book when you can do that kind of stuff. Cool.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because books, you know, what you're referring to is his relationship with the goddess. And without spoiling it, you know, the only reason why in dramatic structure, if people don't love each other, then the story is not as good, is just my opinion, if that makes sense. You know, people who love one another, struggling to get along, or people who don't get along because of where love has led them in life or failed to lead them is to me the thread that holds good stories together. Mm-hmm. And love is about relationships, you know, and the evolution of relationships. And I just think that we all, at a very primal level, we long to love and be loved. Mm-hmm. And feel that we're loved is what makes it worth getting up every day. And to not feel loved makes it very difficult to get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so using that to give readers the elation of the human condition was my plan.
Yeah, which was great. I mean, I really, when I got to that place, I was happy. Now I do want to talk a little bit about the supporting characters.
Oh, cool.
The gnats, for example, these insect, the anthropomorphic insects.
Yeah.
Like, which were very creative. I mean, I just was, whoa. Because I have this thing about insects bother me. So when I saw that, you know, when you see, I see something that is like humanistic and yet still an insect, it kind of put me off.
Well, you know, what's cool about that is that when we originally drew those characters, there was, they were just insect monstrosities. And when we went back to revive the plot and the story with what we'd learned, one of the things that we had learned was how cool props are and how a very simple prop can really give a character a new level. So we decided we were going to give them pickaxes, you know, and it's like, okay, so what's going on with these creatures? Do you know what I mean? Like they are insect monstrosities, yet they have tools. So what's going on in their hive down there? Who are these creatures and what do they know or not know? And so I think that what you're reacting to is giving them a tool. You know, I think that's what gave them that dimension that made them interesting.
Yeah, which is really good. I really like the way they did it. We don't hear, I didn't notice that they ever spoke or I didn't see that they made a lot of noise either. Or they did make clicking noises and things like that. But more than that, I didn't see them. They didn't act too human because it just drives me crazy when I read a book and the insects are talking like people. It just drives me nuts. I just want to rip the book right up when I get to that because there's no way in this world they can possibly do that. So when your insects act like insects most of the time, although they do stand up like men, I really like the way that they were handled. I thought that was really terrific.
Yeah, they represent the danger of the unknown. You know what I mean? It's like when heroes cross when heroes cross from the known into the unknown, they, you know, go beyond the threshold and they, you know, they enter the belly of the beast, if you will. And I mean, so when Nomad goes to the Warlord Palace, that is, although the story is told slightly out of order, but that's kind of the belly of the beast. He's now entering a domain that, you know, the challenges are going to get much harder than what he's used to. And so he encounters these bugs and the bugs, you know, the desert is their realm. And there's a lot we don't know about them because there's a lot he doesn't know about them. And they just represent the danger of the unknown world. Mm-hmm. And you know, the paradox is it's like if you don't jump into the unknown, you'll never be a full human being. But if you do jump into the unknown, you can be destroyed. And so you have to that there you go. Like that's the challenge of life right there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you bring up something that I wanted to talk about too, is that Nomad makes a change in his appearance at one point.
Oh boy.
Which I don't want to spoil, but let's just say he doesn't look exactly the same as when he starts. And I just was, that was to me, there was a change in the character that I think that making that change in his appearance made him, you know, it made it more realistic to me and made it stood out because he's able to change his appearance to indicate something's going on, which I like. But see, remember, comics are a visual medium, you know, the fact that you're able to do that kind of a thing and, you know, kind of communicate things, not necessarily in words, but there are words that talk about it, but also in visuals. I really liked that because I thought it made the character move forward when you did that.
Yeah. He starts off looking one way and he learns new information and he sheds layers and he gets into attack mode. And I think that's what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. He kind of changes his outfit a little bit and he shaves his head, right? He shaves in his face, right? Yeah. And he is preparing to go to face his enemy, and he doesn't think he's ever coming back home, and he has to purge the horrible experience he just had with the gnats and everything that takes place and in that sequence. And so he purges the old to make way for the new. And part of the new is that he doesn't think he's ever coming home. He wants to, but he doesn't think that he is. Mm-hmm. And so he's headed off to what he thinks is his final battle. Mm-hmm. And then we change his appearance again. And I will tell you one thing. If you liked that, you might be the only person who liked that. Because we've had a lot of people be like, I don't understand. Why does he look different? And I don't recommend people doing that unless they have someone like Lee Moyer to really help you make transition work, because that's a complicated transition.
Well, it's progress. You know, when I saw that happen to him, not only was he mentally and verbally making changes, but he was also visually changing himself, which I thought was a strong indicator that the character was moving from one place to another, which mm-hmm. I like that kind of thing. I think that really works for me. So for me, when I saw that, I said, oh, cool. I said, he's really making a transition from one place to another, and you know, it's something we can follow. So I really like that.
I thank you for that. That's like I said, I felt the same way you did, and so I'm glad that I was able to reach one person with that.
I'm sure it wasn't more than me. I'm sure there's other folks out there that really felt that way too about it. But I wanted to also talk about the animals that mm-hmm. appear along the way. There is a time when he's in danger, and he's rescued by what he calls gentle steeds.
Swaths, yeah. Well, you know, everybody in a fantasy adventure has a dangerous sea creature, and so I said, well, why don't we have a sea creature that's helpful, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much, it was that simple. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that he's in danger at sea, and he's rescued by a bunch of whales who are children. And they very innocently lift him up and they play with him. And I think he's sort of, you know, he misses his son, right?
Right.
You know, and so he's rescued by these whales that are kids. And I think he has a brief moment where he, you know, reconnects with, you know, all the good in the world and escapes the tyranny of his reality for a moment. And I thought that beat was cool. So. They may or may not have some relationship to what goes on in the oceans nearby, the land he goes to, and stuff like that. But.
Well, it's very cool. I like those creatures. I do kind of whale-like in some ways, kind of a dolphin/whale.
Yeah. And I've heard that dolphins rescue people who are stranded. I've heard they've been known to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, I mean, that was obviously one of the things I was thinking about. And I think baby beluga. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was in Chicago recently. I saw the beluga whales, and I was like, "Wow, that's just like what we." So I think baby beluga is what we were thinking about.
Now, the first book was called "The City of Empty Towers," and now talk to me about how it came out. Did this come out as a volume first, or did you put them out as individual issues?
The City of Empty Towers was a graphic novel that we started in 2011, and we finished it in 2014. And then from 2014 to 2016, we had to do a lot of revisions. Let me explain something. It is so hard to get people who know what they're doing to come and work with you if you're at the independent level. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, just because you can hire someone doesn't necessarily mean they'll even do the job. So it was a very, very indie book. And we had to go through the art not working before we could get a team on board that could make it work. So we re-released The City of Empty Towers in 2017, like October 2017, with the version that you have. And that's the definitive version. Mm-hmm. But there have been, you know, other editions that were, you know, us learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got to, of course, ask, these days, Kickstarters are real helpful to make these things happen. Did you do a Kickstarter for these?
You know, we did fundraise money, but we didn't do, you know, my issue with the Kickstarter is that I really believe in the fourth wall. And I think that's just the theater student in me. I just think that, you know, if you're a comic book creator and you're Kickstartering your entire project, I also, just because it's just me, I don't have the ability to, you know, necessarily return everything. I mean, it would be so hard for me to mail everybody whatever I said I owed them. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't really have the resources, so I there was money that was fundraised, but not through Kickstarter.
Okay, because honestly, most of the folks I talk to these days do Kickstarters, so if you have a method, that's great for you, because, you know, you're not jumping on board the Kickstarter bandwagon, which I get so frustrated when some great project doesn't make it, and one that I don't particularly like does, and I'm always kind of frustrated with that, but it's great that you're able to figure out another way to make this happen. Now, did you just solicit this through Diamond? How did you do this? You basically do cons. How do you get this out to folks who want to read it?
Well, we do cons, and we're going to make 5 Nomad books, and then we're going to go through Diamond to get them all out there. Ah. So we're going to we're gonna get the story made first, and they're on like Google Books, they're on Comixology, Kindle. You can buy them through print through our website, nomad.net. But when we do distribution, I want to get all five volumes together first. Wow. And that way I can say to Diamond, look, I've got five graphic novels for you, and they're more motivated to do business with you. But I right now I'm just focusing on getting the story together. Mm-hmm. And I want to make enough Nomad that, like, for example, if Nomad is not popular right now because no one's into it, that's cool. We're still going to make it, and maybe it gets popular later, right? Like Fire or Star Trek or something. Mm-hmm. Not that good, but you know, that's the idea. Just get your story made, get your story done, mm-hmm. and you know, move forward.
Because when I saw you at ECCC, you had the beginnings of a second volume. Now, this time you actually have the first individual issue.
Yeah.
Are you doing this differently this time? Because it sounds like you did the graphic novel first, and now you're doing individual issues. What happened to make that change?
Nomad, the second book, which is going to be a trade paperback collected, is going to get released in three volumes. And that was because we just wanted to get story out to people. Mm. So we decided, let's just release it in three parts. And actually, what's cool is that the shorter, floppier books, I think, are easier to make. They're easier to carry. I think people can read them a lot faster. Mm. And so it was a win-win-win.
Cool. And one of the things I really like about it, too, is you have the same team together, and you're following basically the same pattern as you go through this. Now, we mentioned the son, and we see the son in the first story, but he plays a more important role in the second.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil too much, but what role does he play in the second book compared to the first?
Okay, so the first book is the hero's journey of the father, and in mythology, basically a father, Ulysses, you know, whatever, they essentially go on a journey to learn destiny, insight into their destiny, whereas the hero journey of a younger person usually involves them leaving the tribe to collect something to bring it back. So the first book is the hero journey of a father, and the second book takes place from his son's point of view, and it's his life growing up with his dad gone in the volume of the first book, and then he, you know, builds a family and forges relationships, and he tries to find his own destiny in this world, and then one day his dad comes back, but his dad is now linked to this extraordinary destiny, you know, that connects him to goddesses and connects him to aliens and distant worlds and in distant space and things like that. And so the kid is completely blown away. And not only that, but the kid is now linked to his father in this epic journey. So the kid has to go away from his tribe and join his dad in pursuit of an adventure that he never saw coming.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's called The Cave of Broken Tombs, which is, you know, the first one had to do with the city. I gather we're not going to go to a city this time. We're actually going to go to, sounds like tombs, something a different location.
They do go back to the city, but then they're going to have to, I think we introduced the mountains beyond the city in that book, and the mountains are known as the Spikes, mm-hmm. and the Spikes are home to a clan of sorceresses, and the sorceresses have a connection to the city dwellers that were enslaved by the aliens. They've got ancient history with them, and they have animosity towards one another. And so Nomad and his son are going to the city to battle the alien intruders, but along the way, they're going to encounter these sorceresses, and the confrontation is going to, you know, shed light into all of their future.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, too, is I talked a little bit about world building before, and one of the things that you've done, and I really like this, is the fact that you use certain words that we understand, like mom and mother and father and stuff like that. But there are other words, like I think the son is a different word that you use for a son.
The heir?
Sorry?
I think they call him the heir or something like that.
Yeah, that kind of a thing. And so I'm kind of curious. I mean, as a writer, how do you make the decision how far to go? I mean, if you use mother and father, which is something, of course, we can instantly relate to, and yet you make a change like that for the son and stuff. I understand that you're making it something a little different than what we're used to. How far do you want to go in a case like that?
I don't think you should go very far. And if I could have gone back, I might not have made those choices. Mm-hmm. I was at the time, you know, in my cellar working on this. And I was just thinking about how Nomads people see the world. Mm-hmm. And I figured they're going to see their world similar to how we see ours, but there's going to be differences. And they're going to express their interpretation of time and space slightly different than we would. And they're going to have just a slightly different use of words than we will. And if I could have gone back, I might not have done that as much. Mm-hmm. But I don't recommend people doing that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it works for us.
I like it because, you know, for me, you're not coming into something that I don't understand, you know, like spikes instead of mountains and stuff like that. I can easily understand the shift. And in some ways, I was glad that you did it because you make it a little more foreign to us that we're going to.
Is it? I mean, I think the idea that it's a dreamlike experience when you read these books. You know, like it creates a dreamlike experience as you, because, you know, mythology is a story told like a dream that gives do and do not examples of how to experience time and space in that sense. You know, I mean, it's like mythology is how we understand the mystery of what we are. And because what we are is so complicated, you have to, you know, you tell it in a way that is like a dream, because our dreams are very complicated, yet we wake up and we have a feeling that our dream gives us, and we know what we need to do in this situation, and or we do not know, and then we analyze our dream. And so it's so freaking complicated being alive, and we can't know everything, but we do have this mechanism of communication to tell stories like dreams in order to become better problem solvers.
That explains a lot about the choice of color and stuff like that too. It's a little more dreamlike.
Right. Sure. So the idea is that they live in kind of a dreamlike experience, or they express what they see in a dreamlike way. You know, and I think, you know, obviously that, you know, I mean, I read The Gunslinger by Stephen King. That's what he's doing in that book. But you know, it's like myths and legends and things like that. You know, they take liberties with reality, you know what I mean? And the liberties that they take shed some light into what it means to be alive. When done right, it's awesome. And when done bad, it sucks. And, you know, I'm not saying that, like, you know, Nomad did it great or anything like that, but that's what we were trying to do.
Well, I got into it. I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I think the completed graphic novel, as well as the first issue, it's a 46 page volume, you know, so.
The second one.
And I really, I don't want to spoil something, but there's a huge development about 3/4 of the way through. Mm-hmm. And let's just say that the son has something really bad happen in his life, and the father starts to reappear. And the father is able to resolve a situation really well. I was just, you know, it's one of those things where you want to applaud and you cheer, oh yes, all right, I really loved that whole business when a certain thing takes place that's important to the son, and, you know, and then of course I can't spoil that last page. The last page just kills me.
There's a thing in mythology where it's like, and there's a thing, it's basically, it's like you have to preserve the good of your civilization, and the hero's job is to preserve the good of the civilization in order to, you know, you're going to take the good with you onto the next phase of your life, but you're going to either battle or get rid of the tyranny, or get something to help you battle and get rid of the tyranny. And so Nomad comes to Terran's back home, and Nomad helps get rid of the tyranny that's befallen his son. Mm-hmm. And that, you know what I mean? Like, just in that very simple sense. And it's mm-hmm. like, in doing so, he keeps all the good in his son's life around. Mm-hmm. And, it forges a bond between him and his son when the son has a lot of reasons not to trust or like his dad right now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, once you make a hero, the awesome thing is then they get to do heroic stuff. And so the thing that I was thinking is, I was like, all right, maybe Nomad is kind of hard to relate to, especially in that first book, but just wait until he starts doing epic heroic deeds. And if we can structure these stories right, people are going to be like, wow. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad that you got that from that, because that was set up that way intentionally.
Because I was just like, I wanted to cheer. Like I said, I was so happy because there has been a lot of loss.
Yeah.
In parts of these stories. And you know that's normal, but you need to have some loss so that when things like this happen, it explodes off the page. And that was kind of what that did for me. It just was like, I was so happy because I just thought, you know, because this the poor son has been through a lot, to be honest. Yes. And to see him actually see something go his way, shall we say, was really, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was so good. But I think that's one of the things about this your books is that the characters are very vibrant and they literally breathe to me. I know these people, you know, as I get to do them. And it's just a wonderful thing the way that you've constructed this world with all kinds of things going on and all kinds of people and different aspects of it that I'm just gripped by. I'm just kind of fascinated to see what you guys are going to do next, which leads me to my next question. If somebody wants to get a hold of Nomad, how do they do that? You've talked about it's available digitally. I saw you at a convention where I was able to get the paper copies. What's the best ways to do that?
Until we go through distribution, just go on Amazon and just buy a paperback copy from me, and you'll get it in 48 hours.
Okay.
So just Amazon. And then we keep our books in an Amazon warehouse and they send them right out.
Oh, cool.
I highly recommend people doing that because I think that the first book takes some time to get into. It does. And but I think when we get to the end of it, like you described, I think there's a really cool revelation that makes you forge an emotional bond to the characters that makes you want to know more about them. Mm-hmm. And then I think when you get to the second story, because it takes place from the point of view of a young person, that makes it more relatable to more people. Mm-hmm. And what our young character goes through and how his father swoops in to lend a helping hand, mm-hmm. I think will make you forge an even closer bond with those characters. And I'm going to tell you, in that book, they go on one heck of an adventure together.
Oh, wow.
There are things that are going to happen that are going to hopefully blow people's mind.
Oh, cool. We already blew my mind several times in the other books, so I can't imagine what you got in store for us, what you want to do. You've got a website. It's nomadd.net.
That's us.
And are you on Facebook and other social media?
I am. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook, and I could use more Twitter followers. I don't really use the Twitter for much except, sharing art. And I try to stay off of social media because I think I love social media, but I try to not engage, you know, to get things too inflamed or heated or things like that. So I try to just use it to share art.
Yeah, well, what you want to do is promote the comic. You don't want to, because there are some people I know who get out there and let's just say they spend hours and hours and hours on social media not talking about the comic and the stuff that they do. Well, that's what I really want to hear from people. I want to know what it is you're doing, and I want to be able to keep up with that good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it interesting how much the comic book community and the entertainment community in general uses social media to talk about everything except what's awesome about the stuff that they make?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, that's the thing I've learned from just working with Tom Orzechowski is it's like, why doesn't everybody go to Comic-Con and look for the letterers? You know what I mean? Or it's like, why isn't there an enormous section at Comic-Con about the – maybe there are panels that do this. I don't know. But I mean, it's – are that the industry desperately needs to remind people how freaking awesome it is, mm-hmm. and not how terrible and depressing and tyrannical the world can be.
Yep.
And I understand, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like, like yep. heroes set the world right. That's what they do. If they're done well.
They give you hope.
Yeah, they give you hope, right. And it would be good to, you know, just, I don't know. To me, that's the spirit of it all,
yep.
you know.
Yep, yep. Which is great stuff. Of course, now I got to ask, now that I've read the first volume of the three, when is volume two going to show up, might we know?
Okay, so volume two shows up in July or August, and I'll mail you a copy of it.
Ooh.
And then, so stay in touch through Facebook, social media, or Hotmail. And mm-hmm. then we'll conclude the trilogy, hopefully like in October or December, but we'll have everything ready for 2019. And then there's a Nomad's third adventure is being worked on as we speak.
Wow.
Then there's a fourth adventure, which is kind of a prequel, and it's going to take place from the point of view of a young heroine. And then there's going to be a fifth book, and the fifth book is sort of the epic finale of everything. So we've got five Nomad books, and I've got an arc, and I know where I want the character to go.
Very cool. Very cool. I'm looking forward to it because the great thing is you're going to have the third volume out before the holidays, which is perfect timing. I mean, you couldn't time that a lot better unless you had the trade out, you know, the collected version out. That would be nice to have. But on the other hand, I don't mind having the individual issues because I want to be able to read it. I'm one of those guys that I'm not much into collecting. I am much more into reading and enjoying the story. And that's what your book has done for me is taken me into a place I haven't been before. And I'm enjoying the story so much because it is something unusual that I haven't read before. And after decades of reading, whenever I can find that, I really just cherish it. It's terrific.
Well, if you are starting off and you want to ever tell a story, try to tell a story that is personal to you, that you're qualified to tell. And by qualified, I mean you have some biogeographic experience with the content, and then try to show somebody something they've never seen before. But like, stick to your brand. You know what I mean? Like, your brand is everything. Mm-hmm. I think, and I always say this to people. I say, like, you know, your brand is the most important thing that you have as a storyteller. It's how people identify you on the competitive market. So even if your brand isn't that great, it's better to have a brand out there that people know who you are, because that puts you in a position to level up every year with that brand. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And it's, so the name of the game is to get your brand, work it, and don't worry about making a bunch of money on it, because if you structure things too carefully to make a ton of cash, it will probably fall flat.
Yeah.
Right? You know, unless you're already really well established. Yeah. And then just just tell your story from your heart, and but don't let go of your story. Yeah. And don't let someone come in and say, "Hey, wouldn't it be great if this character was an astronaut from Detroit?" I mean, I think if someone had come to James O'Barr and been like, "Yeah, man, I love The Crow. The Crow is so great. But have you ever thought about making it, you know, about a vampire academy?" And you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like, what would James O'Barr have done in that situation? You would have destroyed his soul, destroyed his story, and we would have never had this epic masterpiece that's withstood the test of time.
See, one of the things about your book I know is I can tell you know where you're going.
Yeah.
A good writer knows where they're going, and when we read that, we can tell that you know where you're going. And that's why we can trust you and go along with the story and read and enjoy it. Because I honestly, there are some books I read and I don't think they know where they're going, and I'm pretty convinced I don't know where we're going.
Well, you know, I got a lot of help. I got a lot of help with story with a company called Scenario that's down in Los Angeles, California, and it's run by a gentleman who is he packages story for major motion pictures. And so just a little bit of backstory behind that. When you create something, what you're doing is you're putting yourself in a position to get in the room to make it stronger,
mm-hmm.
right? You know what I'm saying? Like, not making it to be perfect. You're making it to put yourself in a position to have the network where you can go a bit higher with it. Mm-hmm. So when I met the gentleman who runs this company, and he reached out to me and said, you know, I would love to give you some information about some ways that you can structure your ideas that will, and it's story structure. That's what it is, right? It's the fundamental principles of story structure,
right.
Which if you stick to too rigidly, I think you can mess your story up, but if you know what they are and you can play with them, you can make your story stronger. And so he came in and he really, really spent several years helping me understand myself and my story a little bit better. And so like what you're saying about being able to feel that the writer has some idea to know where they're going, that was just because I got some help by some people who are really smart. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing of it is, though, they're helping you tell your story, though. You still had your story.
Exactly.
As far as I'm convinced. But, you know, as I would just say, they helped you bring that and you made it better. Which is, you can always make things a little better and you can always make things a little stronger. And I got that sense when I read these books is that it's just a strong storytelling going, I don't know where you're going, but I know I want to read it. So I'm looking forward to this in the future.
Are you guys going to be able to do a written review of the work at all?
I'm going to try to do that. I'm way behind on my review writings. I've been going to, I was out in Seattle, we're going to a lot of different conventions. I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. I'm going to go to Dallas and stuff, and I can barely do the work and stuff, but I'm going to try to get a review written about it so I can get it out there, because I just when I find something really good, I really want to make sure people know about it. And so that, like with your book, I think we should do that. Now, I do have one more question I want to ask. You were at Emerald City. Yeah. Are there other appearances you're going to do that people can come and see you?
Come find us at WonderCon this weekend in Anaheim. We fly out tomorrow, booth 1223, and then we'll be at Chicago, C2E2, at booth 708, and then we'll do Rose City, Baltimore, New York City, and Stanley's Kamikaze to end the year.
Wow, so I'm going to probably bump into you a couple more times.
Please do.
You know, I'm going to go to Baltimore and all those good kind of things. Well, Drew, you're doing just wonderful stuff, and I let your team know, too, that everybody is just making this book really sparkle. And so, to me, I just can't wait to see what you're going to do next, which is, you know, not many comics do that to me, but yours does.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when I'll have another interview with a great comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.